up to the Food for Your Soul podcast, where we apply the Word of God to the hearts of men and women to stoke the fires of your delight in Christ.
A couple weeks ago, it was hard to imagine anything could possibly push COVID-19 off the headlines, right? Remember, that's just all anybody talked about, every news story, 24-7, COVID, COVID, COVID. That's all there was. Couldn't imagine anything pushing that off. But that's exactly what's happened. Now, it's all about this video. That's video of Derek Chauvin crushing the life out of George Floyd emerged, and riots have exploded across the country, and now that's the news. And that in and of itself isn't really all that surprising. A policeman murders a man on camera while other officers stand by and watch and do nothing. Obviously, people are going to be upset, obviously. What isn't as obvious, though, is why that incident has resulted in the most extreme, bitter, violent divide our country has ever seen in my adult lifetime. That's strange, because the initial reaction to the killing was about as unified as I've ever seen our country since 9/11. I don't know any time when our country was more unanimous agreement on something as when that video emerged and everyone was in 100%, everyone you talked to, everyone on TV, everyone online, everyone was in absolute, complete, total agreement condemning what Derek Chauvin did. Now, usually when something like that happens, and everybody's reacting immediately to, oh, look at this, you know, thing this terrible cop did, or I'm usually the type that's, hold on, you know, let's wait till the facts are in. You can't trust the media. They skew things. There might be more to it than meets the eye. I'm usually that guy. But this time, even people like me were saying, we don't need any more information. This is flat out murder. No question about it. So that was an amazing moment in our country. A rare, rare instance where our bitterly divided country that agrees on nothing, even we can't even agree on COVID, you know, there's something that you wouldn't even think would be political, turns into a huge political divide. A country like that was in 100% lockstep agreement on something. And then days later, you have the most bitter divide ever in our country, where friends and family are at each other's throat, fighting. One friend said even on her gardening Facebook group, people were fighting. And that's a group where nobody ever talks about politics. And yet, even on that group, people were all bitter, angry, fighting. Why? How did that happen? How do we go from the greatest unity to the most extreme division? What is going on in this country right now baffles the imagination. It would be one thing if anarchists had just overwhelmed the government and took over. But here, in this case, you have governments in complicity with what's going on. They're actually applauding it in many cases. You have government officials keeping harmless working people locked down at home, kept away from their jobs so that they don't get sick, while rioters are allowed to just run free in cities, destroying the places that those people earn their living. Lock up the weak and fearful and let the strong run loose and create havoc. Demand justice when one man's life is taken, and then applaud the lawless mob of criminals attacking the police and murdering innocent people, mostly black people that are being hurt by these riots. You can't shop in a store, but you can loot it. You can't work, but you're free to steal. You can't attend church, but you can burn one down. You can't eat in a restaurant, but you can demolish it. It's just insanity what's going on. And now we're seeing charges being brought in these riots, not against the rioters, but against the police. And you have authorities and blatantly announcing, we are not going to bring any charges against these rioters that are doing these horrific things. And celebrities and politicians making millions of dollars of donations, not to help these poor people whose businesses got wiped out, but to bail the looters out of jail. John MacArthur said, if you worship the God of anger, the God of hate, the God of vengeance, you can have church anywhere, anytime, indoors or outdoors, without any restrictions or rules. You're completely free to worship the God of mayhem. How did this happen? How did we ever get here? Well, I believe it came in two stages. First, division arose the moment the whole issue became about racism, because this country is, we agree on what Derek Chauvin was evil, we agree that, but when it comes to racism, our country is bitterly divided over two things, over the definition of racism and the solution to racism. One side believes in one solution, one definition, and one solution that comes from that definition, and the other side believes in the exact polar opposite of that solution. They are completely incompatible. They're opposites. And so, we start arguing about those things. We start arguing about racism, the definition of it, the solution to it. And then, as that argument heated up, people, and this is important, people who want to see this country as it exists destroyed, took advantage of the opportunity of that argument and fomented the chaos that we're seeing now. And it was very intentional, and I'll explain how it worked. So let me just kind of walk through each step of that, and I'll at the end, I'll offer what I believe is a biblical solution. First, the definition of racism and the solution. The way you define racism affects your beliefs about the solution. One side says that racism has to do with thinking negatively about someone because of their ethnicity. Right? That's racism. That's what Martin Luther King, that's how he would define it. Judging someone by their skin color. In one of the most famous speeches ever delivered, he had a dream. Remember, I have a dream of a time when a man will be judged by the content of his character, not by the color of his skin. That was his dream. He wanted us, a colorblind society, he didn't want us to focus on skin color. So if that's what racism is, if we go with Martin Luther King's way of thinking about it, then the solution, very simple. Ignore skin color. Ignore skin color. Don't ever prejudge anybody by the way they look. So if a person's skin color has zero effect on how you feel about that person, then by this definition, then you're not a racist. And if it does have an effect, if you look at someone and their skin color has an effect on how you feel, then you are a racist. That's one definition. That's one side believes. The other side says, no, that's way too simplistic. There's far more to it than that. That's one part of racism, but there is much more to it. That's only one form. The real problem goes way beyond that personal internal attitude to a systemic institutional racism. There was a story in the New York Times just yesterday about how the Merriam-Webster Dictionary is now changing their definition of racism to fit that second way of thinking about it. A 22-year-old woman wrote a letter asking them to change their definition because she kept getting in, she's getting in debates with people about racism, and she was talking about all this systemic stuff and everything, and they were using the old definition, the Martin Luther King way of thinking about it, and the way they kept quoting the Webster Dictionary, they just cut and paste the dictionary definition, say, see, this is racism, and she got fed up with that, so she appealed to Merriam-Webster to change the definition, and they agreed to do it. So now, with a new definition, you can have zero animosity in your heart towards any minority, any ethnic group, completely ignore skin color altogether, and still be guilty of racism. The idea is this, with this new definition. The idea is this country was founded on racist principles. It was built on the backs of slaves. And so the institutions themselves operate on racist premises and ideals, so that everything is rigged in favor of white people. That's the institute, and they speak of systemic racism, which means the legal and the economic systems are inherently racist in the way that they operate. And so it works in a self-perpetuating cycle. There's no way out of it. We had laws that discriminated against blacks and put them in poor neighborhoods and bad housing, bad education, bad schools, all that. And the result of that was they didn't get education. They didn't have the same opportunities that white people had. And that just perpetuated this never-ending cycle that they can't get out of the ghetto and all that. On top of all that is a legal system that's also stacked against the blacks, so that a disproportionate number of blacks end up in prison or are killed by police or harassed or whatever. And that's just our system. And if you participate in that system, or even if you benefit from that system, then you're part of racism, even if you have nothing but love in your heart towards black people. Doesn't matter. You're still guilty of racism because you're part of that system and you're benefiting from it. So if that's your definition, if you go with that definition, then what's the solution? It's the exact opposite of what Martin Luther King fought for, right? Instead of treating whites and blacks the same, the solution now is to treat them differently. That's what I'm saying. It's the opposite. Blacks need to be given preferential treatment based on their skin color to make up for injustices that were inflicted on them by whites in the past. And that starts with white people just simply understanding and acknowledging the systemic racism and then realizing they have white privilege. And understanding that as a white person, that you've never faced what blacks have to face. You've never had to worry every single time you go out of your house that you might be gunned down by a cop or dragged out of your car for no reason. Or hunted down. LeBron James said, we're literally, quote, we're literally hunted, all caps, every day, every time we set foot outside the comfort of our homes, end quote. That's what life is like for people like LeBron James. Literally hunted. From there, first we need to just realize that, we need to acknowledge that as white people, and then from there you see a whole lot of symbolism. Everything from posting a black square on your Instagram or social media or taking a knee or sometimes, in some cases, prostrating yourself and kissing the feet of black people. You see there's some viral videos going around where white people are doing that. So all that symbolism, all that's just the beginning. The real solution is just to burn down the whole racist system. Just get rid of the entire system. Now, if you want to understand the origins of this, then you need to do some reading in what's called critical theory. Okay? Critical theory. Critical theory is something that originated back in the 1930s, and it's the basis for not only this understanding of the definition of racism, but similar ideas about education, about social justice, about LGBTQ ideologies, and all of that. And you could spend years and years reading about critical theory. There's so much to it. But the bottom line is basically this. Society is divided up in terms of power. The oppressed and the oppressors. Okay? That's society. It's kind of this Marxist idea. And it's where all identity politics come from. You've heard that phrase, identity politics. This idea that you're oppressed not based on what's happened to you. As an individual. That's irrelevant. But based on what group you're a part of. Your skin color, your gender, your sexual orientation, all that. If you're in that group, you're oppressed. If you're not in that group, you're not oppressed. If you're an oppressor, you're not an oppressor based on what you do or didn't do to anyone. It's totally based on your skin color, gender, and all the rest. If you want a great analysis of critical theory and read about it and get some ideas, the impact that it's having on the church, which is very scary, a real solid perspective on that is Neil Chevenny, he's got a great website. It's ChevennyApologetics.com. That's S-H-E-N-V, Victor, I, Apologetics.com. All one word, ChevennyApologetics.com. I do recommend that website. Go ahead and go to that. But anyway, for our purpose, let's just talk about this. How did all this violence erupt? That's the main point that I want to make. But before we talk about that, let me give a quick response to the idea of this systemic racism. First, the idea that this country is built on the backs of slaves. Actually, it wasn't built on the backs of slaves. The South was, the plantations were, and then we went to war because white people objected to that, and the North won that war, and the North was built based mostly on industry, industrialism. And not on slaves. So, it wasn't really, there was slavery and it was horrible, but that's not what founded the country. It's not how the country became prosperous. The question of systemic racism, does it even exist? Is there systemic racism? Is there institutional racism in the United States according to this new definition? It's true that we did have horrible racist laws. They're called the Jim Crow laws segregation, housing discrimination, all that was clearly racist and horrible. However, those have ended now. Ever since the 60s, that's been illegal. At the federal level, all those kinds of laws, anything discriminating on a basis of skin color or minority status is completely illegal now. You can't do that at the federal level. That's it's been that way for 60 years. And if a minority is discriminated against and they go to court, they consistently win in court. The legal system is upholding that. So it's illegal now. You can't deny someone housing because of their skin color. You can't do that. All those kind of racist laws are gone now. They're gone. Stokely Carmichael and Charles V. Hamilton wrote about this whole concept of systemic racism back in 1967 in a book called Black Power, The Politics of Liberation. Here's what they said. When a black family, because I want to read this to you because this is in refuting what I just said. I just said, oh, that's all illegal. And they would say, ah, oh, not so fast. Not so fast. Because they say this. When a black family moves into a home in a white neighborhood and is stoned, burned, or routed out, then they're victims of an overt act of individual racism, which most people would condemn. But it is institutional racism that keeps black people locked in dilapidated slum tenements, subject to daily prey of exploitative slumlords, merchants, loan sharks, discriminatory real estate agents, that either society pretends it does not know of this latter situation or is in fact incapable of doing anything meaningful about it. So that's the idea. It's not like there's an explicit law saying you can't move into this house, but just the way the thing's set up, they're locked in this cycle. Are there institutional structures that keep blacks locked in the slums? And if so, what are they? Well, one suggestion that many black leaders, like Clarence Thomas and so on, are saying is that it's the thing that's keeping them locked there, more than societal structures, is fatherlessness, not having fathers in the home. The number one predictor of poverty in the United States is having a child out of wedlock. Nothing will guarantee poverty in your life more than doing that. Regardless of skin color, regardless of the culture where you live, if you have a baby out of wedlock, almost guarantees a life of poverty more than any other factor, including education. About 20% of white children grow up without a father in the home, while 58% of black children don't have a father in the home. It's not surprising that there's a lot of poverty, right? Is that institutional racism? I think so. I think in one sense it is. Because why are there so many single black mothers among the black community? It's because for decades, well-meaning politicians have passed laws offering financial incentives for that. They're actually better off without a father in the home with regard to their welfare that they receive. And there are benefits that encourage that. So politicians that put those laws in order, they thought they were doing those women a favor, but what they've done instead is create a whole culture that's just locked in eternal poverty. What about laws that unfairly impact blacks? Now, there's no laws that say, well, if you're black, then this is illegal, but if you're white, then it's okay. We don't have laws like that anymore. But they'll argue, well, but there's laws that they impact black people disproportionately than white people. Is that true? Well, no doubt. I wouldn't argue that that's true. But we need to distinguish between laws that disproportionately impact blacks and laws that unfairly impact blacks. Because just because it's disproportionate doesn't necessarily mean it's unfair. I'll give you an example. What about laws against insider trading? What percentage of the people that go to jail for insider trading on Wall Street, what percentage of them do you think are white men? I'm guessing 90 plus, you know, maybe 99. Does that mean that insider trading laws targeted white males? No. No. Is it racist against white males? No. No, it's just that a law regulating an area where mostly white men work, and so when people break those laws, it's going to tend to be a lot of white males. So there's nothing unfair about that. Now, if a law imposed a stricter penalty based on skin color, then that would clearly be racist, but there are no laws that do that. What about the proportion of blacks in prison? You very often hear this. You got way too many blacks. Blacks are only 13% of the population. Yet they're in the prisons. They make up a huge percentage. So that's out of balance. Does that prove some kind of racial bias in the system? No, it does not. The reason so many black men end up in prison in the system is because how often they commit crimes. 50% of all murders are committed by black men. Black males make up 7% of the population in the United States, and they commit 50% of the murders. According to economist John Lott, writing in 2014, he said this: based on most recent available FBI crime numbers, black male teenagers were 9 times more likely to commit murder than their white counterparts. 900% more likely to commit a murder than their white counterparts. The Wall Street Journal, Jason Riley, wrote 2014, blacks commit violent crimes at 7 to 10 times the rate that whites do. Now, why is that? Is it because they're black? Is there something inherent in them that makes them commit crimes? No. No. Again, it's not hard to trace it back to the fatherlessness, right? I mean, that makes sense. And the reason it's not hard is because if you study black people who grow up in homes with a mom and a dad in the home, then you don't find those high crime numbers. So it's not too hard to connect the dots there. But whether it's related to fatherlessness or something else, whatever the reason, the point is this. The point is that they are committing a disproportionate number of the crime, so it stands to reason that those who end up in prison, the number would also be disproportionate. Is it true that all blacks, including LeBron James, are being hunted in the streets every day? Are whites out there slaughtering black people, like you hear online all the time? No, it's not true. Blacks actually killed twice as many whites as whites killed blacks. In 2015, blacks killed 500 whites, and whites killed 229 blacks. That's amazing when you think that blacks only make up 13% of the population. In 2018, according to the FBI's Bureau of Justice Statistics, there were about 600,000 non-homicide violent white-black crimes each year, with 90% of them involving a black perpetrator and a white victim. 90%. Only 10% was a white perpetrator and a black victim. So are blacks being slaughtered in the streets? Yes, they are. They are. The population of Chicago is about one-third black, and yet blacks account for 80% of their homicide victims. They're being slaughtered in Chicago. The number one cause of preventable deaths for young white males is accidents, like car accidents and so on. The number one cause for black males is homicide. They're being slaughtered. They are being gunned down in the street. So yeah, Chicago, by far, most murder victims are black. They're being slaughtered in the streets, but not by whites and not by police. 90% of black murder victims are killed by other blacks, which is why you don't hear about it. What happened to George Floyd, that kind of thing happens to black men in Chicago every single day. It's not unusual in a weekend for 20 or 30 black young men to be gunned down, murdered, in Chicago. And this is going year after year after year after year. If one black man, if George Floyd, if that's a tragedy, this is a huge tragedy, right? But you don't hear anything about it because it happens at the hands of other blacks. Now, have some police unjustly killed some black men? Yes. Yes, it's very rare, but it happens. It actually happens more often with whites. Several recent studies found that cops are more hesitant and more reluctant to pull the trigger on a black suspect than on a white one. One such study was conducted by black Harvard economist Roland Fryer, who said that he was expecting the exact opposite. He did the study because he was trying to prove that they shoot blacks more often. And so he did the study, and he found out it was the opposite, and he said that conclusion was the most, quote, surprising result of my career, end quote. It shocked him. 2015, Justice Department of the Philadelphia Police showed that, the department study of the Philadelphia Police showed that white officers are less likely to shoot an unarmed black person than a black officer or a Hispanic officer. Police are more likely to shoot a white man than a black man, given the same circumstances. And a police officer is 18 and a half times more likely to be killed by a black male than an unarmed black male is likely to be killed by a police officer. Now, are there racist cops? Of course there are racist cops. Most cops are good men who risk their lives every day for our safety, and I thank God for them. But there are some very bad ones, obviously. In fact, I would say there's way, way too many bad cops. Way too many. There are evil people in every category in this society, including law enforcement. The problem is, in most jobs, the evil people get fired. But with police, they don't get fired, mainly because of the unions. Firing a cop is kind of like firing a school teacher, because the unions make it so hard, so it's next to impossible to... And that's why a guy like Derek Chauvin, who should not have been on the street, he should have been fired a long time. He had so many complaints against him. Why wasn't he fired? Well, because of the union protection. I'd love to see an end to the unions, so that we could, among the police, so we could get rid of the bad cops like that. Even more, I wish there was a way to deal with the corruption among the prosecutors. I think that's a far worse problem in our justice system, but that's a whole other video. As for institutional racism, according to the old definition, I think it does exist, but in reverse. It's racist. There is racism in favor of minorities. I have a friend who had a child as a single mom right out of high school, out of wedlock, with a white, she's black, the father was white, and she had light complexion, so the baby was really light-complected, and she actually went out of her way to make sure that on that baby's birth certificate it said black. And I said, why is that such a big deal to you? Why do you why is that so important? She said, because I want my child to have some opportunities. She said, there's so many more scholarships, so many more hiring opportunities, so much more if you're a minority. I just want her to have the opportunities. There's no question there's racial bias in favor of minorities in our system. You doubt that? Try to get a scholarship if you're a white male in the college. And you don't have good grades. That's not going to happen. And many black, and I'm not complaining about that. I think if people want to give money to whoever they want to give it to, that's their business. That's perfectly okay. I'm just saying that there are advantages. And many blacks, such as Clarence Thomas and Candace Owens, are arguing that those systems don't actually give advantages. They're doing blacks more harm than good. If you get a black person accepted into a school that they couldn't get into just from their grades, but they're accepted because of a quota system, then they can't compete in that environment, and they don't do well, and it causes them more trouble, more harm than good. Okay, so that's my response to the idea of institutional racism. There is no institutional racism. There's no systemic racism. But what about this question of where all this anger and hostility and violence came from? What is going on with that? How did that just come out of the blue so fast? You might think that in a moment where there's entire countries in 100% agreement against an act of brutality, activists would be dancing in the streets. Yes, everybody finally sees the problem. Everybody agrees. You'd think they'd be happy. They were not. Instead, they turned it into something that half of this country hates. Why? Why did that happen? Well, no doubt there's many reasons why it happened, and I don't pretend to know them all. My guess is, for some people, they didn't like all that agreement. They didn't like all that agreement because they knew a good deal of it was from people like me, who were outraged at what happened, not because a white cop killed a black man, but because a cop killed a man. And they didn't want that to be why everyone agreed. They didn't want it to be, well, a bad cop killed an innocent man, and therefore we're upset. No, it has to be because a white cop killed a black man. For a lot of activists, the fact that George Floyd was black is the main point. That's the thing that makes it evil. That's the biggest thing that makes it so evil. And that would explain why the George Floyd video went viral, but the Daniel Shaver video didn't. Now, you probably never heard of the Daniel Shaver video because it didn't go viral. I feel bad for even mentioning that video, because I know some of you are going to be curious and you're going to pull it up online and watch it and then regret watching it. I'm warning you right now, something you can't unsee. It is horrible. It is disturbing. You get this officer shouting at this white kid, looks like a teenager, barking out all these instructions. Do this, cross your leg, cross your hand, put your hands up, kneel. And he's just like barking out, and the kid is freaking out, and the kid's scared to death. He's crying, he's laying on his face, he's got his feet crossed, hands out, everything the cop says, he's trying to follow it. The cop tells him, all right, now get on your knees, crawl on your knees, and he does it, and he's like trying to do everything, and the cop is screaming the instructions, the kid's crying even more, begging for his life, trying to follow the instructions. Kid does one thing wrong with his hands, bam, 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 five shots, shoots him dead. It is absolutely sickening to watch. It was just sickening. That officer was just acquitted. Now, why didn't that go viral? Why didn't that cause riots? Was it because it was a white kid? The reality is, most people are just as outraged over that happening to a white kid as they are about George Floyd. But there's not organizations that use incidences like that to incite violence like there are with the George Floyd situation. And chief among those organizations is Black Lives Matter, which has to be one of the most misnamed organizations out there. That's a terrible name for that organization. If black lives really mattered to them, they wouldn't be silent about the vast majority of blacks who are murdered, gunned down in the streets by other blacks. Blacks are being slaughtered, and they don't even care. They don't even talk about that ever. Last year, there were 9 unarmed black people killed by police. 9. 19 white people, 9 black people. Black Lives Matter protests those 9 and says nothing about the thousands of other black people that are murdered. Nothing. Nor do they say anything about the tens of thousands of black babies who are aborted. But again, that's a whole other video. They don't seem to care at all about the vast majority of black lives. Black lives don't matter to them. Black lives have never mattered less. Why? Why is that? Because their organization has nothing to do with black lives. It's about Marxism. Just look at their material. Just look at their website. Look at their own, what they say. They call themselves a Marxist organization. That movement is completely driven by that whole critical theory that I mentioned earlier and the ideals of Marxism. And in that system, the only sin is being in power. If you're part of that power group, sin. That's sin. And guilt or innocence is determined by what people group you're in, not by individual guilt or responsibility. There's no individual responsibility. That's why they think it's fine for them to loot and commit violence, destroy things, start things on fire, kill people, beat people. It doesn't matter. They aren't guilty. They aren't guilty because they can't be guilty because they're part of the oppressed people group. This is that whole way of thinking. On the other hand, if you're white, you're part of the oppressing group. You're an oppressor, which means you're guilty no matter what you do or don't do or believe or don't believe. Doesn't matter. You're just part of that group, so you're guilty. And this isn't my opinion. Black Lives Matter happily self-identifies as a neo-Marxist movement, and they've been in favor of defunding the police for all along. You're thinking, where did that come from? That's not out of the blue. That's been their objective all along. And it's not just because they're trying to curb police brutality. It's because they want anarchy. Because that's what it's going to take to dismantle this whole oppressive capitalistic patriarchal system and get rid of it. They want the whole system to burn to the ground. Now, do all the protesters out there want that? Peaceful protest? No. Of course not. But organizations like Black Lives Matter take advantage of peaceful protests. They do this all the time. There's not enough of them to really get a good riot going. So they glom on to big protests and try to turn them into violent protests to serve their agenda. This is what they do. They're very organized. They know exactly what they're doing. That's why there were truckloads of bricks dropped in strategic places in the neighborhood for those rioters. And the locations of the riots, the precincts that were taken, all planned, all orchestrated. This is all matter of record. There's a small group of people who want to destroy our entire culture, and they take advantage of larger movements like the protests over George Floyd to get it done. And violence is a key, crucial part of it. It's always the case with any insurgency. That's what they do. You just look what's going on in Iraq with the insurgents there. They make life so miserable for everyone and so dangerous that finally people say, well, if the police can't protect us, maybe these insurgents can. We'll just join up with them. Gangs use that tactic in the inner cities. Same tactic. Police can't protect me. Only the gang can protect me, so I'll join the gang. These people are trying to do that to the entire culture. Now, that's no surprise. If you understand anything about Marxism and history and how it has gone and what drives it, what is surprising is how many people fall for it. I would have thought that most people, once they saw the riots and the horrific things that were happening with that, the beatings and the fires and all the rest, I would have thought the whole culture would have turned on Black Lives Matter and just say, wow, now that they're exposed, that's what they are, and the whole culture would have just violently turned against them. But instead, you have all these people kneeling and posting the black boxes on social media and an alarming number of people across the country being fired for speaking out against Black Lives Matter or even failing to speak in favor of Black Lives Matter. You get journalists, public officials, professors, businessmen being fired. It's just shocking. And what's really sad is how many Christians are falling for it. A lot of Christians hear stories about how blacks have experienced oppression and they had a rough life and they feel for them, they have empathy, which is good, which is very good. But then they buy into the Marxist solutions instead of the biblical solutions. So let's talk about the solutions. The solution to racism is not more racism. The more we keep identifying people by skin color, the worse racism is going to get. There are two problems. Racism and injustice. And those are two problems with two different solutions. The solution to racism is very simple. Ignore skin color. Period. Ignore skin color. That's the solution to racism. Treat people as people, not as members of skin color groups. The murder of George Floyd was evil because George Floyd was human. That's why it was evil. Not because he was black. Not because Chauvin was white. The fact that he was black didn't make it more evil. The fact that Chauvin was white didn't make it more evil. The fact that Chauvin was an authority figure did make it more evil. Because there's a special concern that God has in Scripture but about misuse of authority. And I'll get to that in a second. But skin color is not relevant. It's not relevant. We don't know for sure that it was even race was as a motive. We don't know that. For all we know, Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd for some other reason. And it doesn't matter what the reason was, because the reasoning behind it isn't what makes murder evil. The humanity and innocence of the victim is what makes it evil. So the solution to racism is to ignore skin color. What about injustice? What's the solution to that? You ready for this? The solution to injustice is justice. Justice. And justice is carried out through law and order, not through anarchy. There's no justice in anarchy. Anarchy is the most unjust of all systems. You ever wonder why there's so many vicious tyrants in running countries around the world? How that happens? Why people allow that to happen? It happens because of anarchy. What happens is you destroy law and order, you have total anarchy, the people are brutalized and savaged by the mob, and it becomes so unbearable that people will accept anyone who can bring a little bit of law and order, they'll accept anyone. And so the tyrant comes in there and he brings some law and order and gets some police going and so everyone just says, all right, this is a lot better than what we had. That's how it happens time and time again. And that's what they're trying to do here. Because not even the worst mass murdering tyrant dictator is as bad as anarchy. Nothing is as bad as anarchy. So God gave us a solution to injustice. It's government authority. Romans 13, verse 1. Everyone must submit themselves to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. You want to be free from fear from the one in authority? Do what is right, and he'll commend you. For he's God's servant. This is God's design. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. God gave him the sword. God gave him those guns. He's God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. That's what protects us from injustice. That's what protects us from anarchy. So you don't want trouble with the police? Don't break the law. The fewer run-ins you have with the police, the less chance you'll run into one of the bad ones. And you say, well, wait a minute, what about the corrupt police? What about when the system is corrupt? What about when the government court system, all the justice system, doesn't do its job? They're not serving what is God intended. Well, there's various ways that we can seek redress of grievances in our country. We've got different branches of government. There's a lot of things we can do. Sometimes those things work, sometimes they don't. There's no perfect system. We should seek justice the best we can, keep fighting for it, keep trying to bring that about by peaceful means available to us, but not by destroying the system. That's not going to bring justice. And here's why. If we tear down the system, who's going to take over? Black Lives Matter? You want them in charge? You just watch those rioters. Just watch them. Do you want them in charge? I mean, you really think that if we put the Marxists and the black activists in charge, that they would be kind and benevolent leaders, and there would be no more brutality and no more injustice? No, Jesus is very clear in Mark 10. Those who rise to power in this world lord it over those who are under them. It happens every time. Doesn't matter who they are, doesn't matter what skin color, they will oppress the people under. That's just natural human nature. That's why our system in this country is built with so many checks and balances, to try to put a limit on some of that. Because it's just human nature. And if you doubt that, just look at what the people in power do. If you have 50 rioters versus one cop, and you don't have to look very far through the videos to see instances of this. 50 rioters, one cop. What happens? Who's in power there? In that situation, right there, who's in power? The cop? No. It's the rioters who have the power, right? They've got the power now. And what do they do with that power? Act in benevolence? No. They try to kill the cop. Those people are not fighting injustice. They just want to be the ones inflicting the injustice. Problem is, many Christians are falling for this whole way of thinking. They're falling for the whole thing. I just got an email today with a link to an article from crosswalk.com about how white Christians should respond to racial tensions. And he gave 5 points, and number one point was, recognize your own whiteness. And here's what he said. I'll read you the point. He says, unfortunately, this critical first action will likely be the most controversial statement in this entire article. Many of my white brothers and sisters have a visceral reaction to this. When they hear Black Lives Matter, they respond with All Lives Matter. And when you use the phrase white privilege, they proceed to describe to you their own hardships and how they had to work and get to where they are. White privilege is not about, it's not a reference to any hardship or lack thereof a white person has experienced. Rather, it's noting that skin color has not been one of them. Did you get that? So the point there is that it doesn't matter what hardships you've encountered. As a white person, you've got white privilege. Doesn't matter what hardship. If one of your hardships wasn't skin color, then you don't understand what it's like for a black person. And you need to recognize that. That's what he's arguing. And then he goes on. He says, I'm a hardworking person. This is a white guy writing this. I put a lot of hours and sweat to get where I am. But I realize the advantages I was born with, that I had no control over. Two loving parents in the home, access to food and resources, access to a college education, social capital that comes through all those things. I've never been denied an opportunity or been looked at suspiciously because of my race. On the contrary, there are societal and systemic issues that are holding back others who don't look like me. And my heart breaks when I, now get this, my heart breaks when I think about the difficult conversation African-American parents have to have with their children. Benjamin Watson, author of Under Our Skin, writes about this, and this his experience having the talk, in quotes, with his children in the Players Tribute. The talk takes many shapes, but it, at its core, it's the conversation black parents must have with their kids about what it means to be black in America. The guy says, oh, it's frightening. It's heartbreaking to think about that, but black parents have to have that talk with their kids. That is a frightening thing for me to read. For black parents to sit their kids down, I don't think all black parents do this, but the ones that do, they sit their kids down and have a talk with them about how underprivileged they are. There are few things that you could do to a child to destroy his life worse than that. Few things. If you teach a kid that he's starting out with two strikes against him, he's disadvantaged, he's underprivileged, and all the hardships that happen to you, little Johnny, are due to white people. Of, of, Of course he's going to grow up hating whites. And he's going to grow up defeated. Just think of how many times, just think about this. What if that happened to you? How many times in your life have you been mistreated by somebody? How many? This is your whole life. How many times have you been mistreated? Imagine that your parents taught you from the time you were a child that whenever somebody mistreats you, it's because of your skin color. Then by now you would have just like a mountain of proof of racism, right? You're just like, man, have I been mistreated because of my race. Right? How many times has someone mistreated you and you had no idea why? Now, most of us, that happens and we're like, I don't know why that happened. Most of us, somebody at church gives us a funny look and we have no idea why. We just walk away thinking, wonder what was that it was about? I don't know. Or maybe we guess, but if you've been trained to think people look down on you because of your skin color, you're disadvantaged because of your skin color, people hate you because of your skin color, and then every time you get one of those looks at church and you don't know what it is, you're going to say, oh, it's because I'm black. I know that. I've had black people tell me that. They say, yeah, people in this church look at me funny all the time because I'm black. It's like, how do you know this? Because you're black. That could be, it's like, well, there's a million reasons why they might do it. But if you train people to think that way, then that's what they're going to think. And that's the height of cruelty because you sentence those people to a life of self-pity. And nothing is more miserable than self-pity. I know that from experience. It is miserable. And few things are harder to recover from than the pit of self-pity. It is a horrible, horrible existence. And it's not loving to perpetuate that kind of thinking in anyone. Showing empathy, showing sympathy, that's great, that's great. Definitely need to do that. But we should not be a party to a cultural attitude that promotes self-pity for anybody. And I see the same problem, this is another topic, but I see the same problem with victims of sexual abuse. Very often counselors will tell them, oh, you're damaged forever. You're damaged, you're ruined. And they tell them all this stuff that just convinces them they're messed up for life. And it ends up being a self-fulfilling prophecy. Horrible thing to do to somebody. The fact that the writer of that article just dismissed the troubles of white people, as all the hardships of white people, just dismissed that. Like, it's not because of your skin color, so that's irrelevant. That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. There are white people who face far worse disadvantages than many black people. Obviously. Compare Johnny Erickson Tata with LeBron James. Now, Johnny was paralyzed from the neck down as a teenager in an accident. She's lived her whole life in a wheelchair, unable to move, and yet still has pain somehow. Severe pain all the time. LeBron James was a millionaire right out of high school and is worshipped basically as a god in our culture. Johnny may not have been denied opportunities because of her skin color, but from a human point of view, would you say that she's had more opportunities available to her than LeBron James has had available to him? That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Everyone suffers hardship. Everyone is treated unfairly. Some people get treated more unfairly than other people. Some people get treated far worse, far better. But to say all people with black skin fit in the category of underprivileged and all people with white skin fit in the category of privileged is the height of absurdity. And it's racist. If we have to just stop and recognize our white privilege, and that's the solution, what about other privileges? What about really smart black people? Do they need to stop and consider their IQ privilege? Because if you got a very high IQ, you definitely have way more opportunities in this world than somebody who's white who has an IQ of 80, who'll never be able to hold down a job. What about a black person who's very attractive compared to a white person who happens to be really ugly? Does an attractive person in our culture have more privileges and opportunities than a white, ugly person in our culture? You better believe it. What about wealth privilege or health privilege or athletic privilege or friends privilege or family privilege? All of us have a bunch of privileges. All of us have a bunch of disadvantages. So what's the proper response if you've got a whole lot of privileges? Like the guy that wrote this article, he's got all kinds of privileges, right? What's the best response? White guilt? groveling, kissing the feet of some black person that doesn't have the same privileges, virtue signaling on Facebook with a black box, and show that you're so woke that you understand better than everyone else? No. The response God calls us to when He gives us special privilege is not guilt, but gratitude. Right? Not guilt, gratitude. Gratitude. If you have white privilege or any other kind of privilege, be thankful to God. And you do have lots of privilege. Lots of privilege. Be thankful to God. That's number one. Number two, use those privileges to do what? Serve others. Serve others. What about your disadvantages? Well, the wrong response to having disadvantages is self-pity and envy, right? Don't feel sorry for yourself, and don't envy people that have what you don't have. Instead, you trust God who decides who gets what privileges. Be thankful for the privileges you have, and be content. Jesus told a parable about workers in the field. Some got paid a denarius for working 12 hours, and someone else got paid a denarius for working only 1 hour, got the same pay, or a whole day's pay. What's the proper response to the first group who didn't have the privilege of getting only having to work 1 hour? Self-pity? Protest? Envy? No. Trust, gratitude, and contentment. That would have been the right response. They got a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. They should have been thankful and content. If you're LeBron James, don't envy Johnny Tata's white privilege or wallow in self-pity because you're black. Thank God that you've got a 40-inch vertical jump and you don't have to live your life in a wheelchair. And use all your strength and health and money and power and popularity to serve people. And if you're Johnny Tata, don't be envious of LeBron James' legs. Be thankful that you've been chosen from the foundation of the world to be a child of God and use your relationship with God to serve people, which is exactly what Johnny Tata has done, thankfully. So how should we respond to this, all this racial strife? First, don't fall for the Marxist way of thinking about people, dividing them into classes and tribes according to things like skin color. Don't fall for that. It's tempting because it seems like it's the compassionate thing to do. It's not. Second, be thankful for the privileges you have and use those privileges to serve people. And third, trust God with your disadvantages and strive to learn contentment and to help others around you learn contentment.
Thank you for listening. We pray these principles from the Word of God are helping you find the peace of God as you draw nearer to the God of peace. Please remember to pray for this ministry, and remember that we're a crowd-funded ministry, so every gift helps. Just go to treasuringgod.com. Until next time, rejoice in the Lord always, and set your mind on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God.